Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ross Eisenbray, Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute, who talks about the effect of the financial crisis on America's working class. Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project, who assesses the voting records of presidential candidates Senators Barack Obama and John McCain on criminal justice issues not widely discussed in this year's campaign. And author and media critic Mark Crispin Miller, who discusses his concerns about the integrity of this November's U.S. presidential and congressional election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The former president of Finland, Martti Ahtisaari, has won the 2008 Nobel Peace Prize for decades of backroom diplomacy to resolve heated conflicts in southern Africa, Kosovo, and the breakaway Aceh region in Indonesia. The longtime diplomat now runs the Crisis Management Initiative, which in recent months has worked to settle the differences between Sunni and Shiite Muslims in Iraq. Ahtisaari told a Norwegian public broadcaster that his greatest accomplishment was creating a path for Namibian independence in the late 1970s and 80s. He was the United Nations envoy in talks between the Southwest Africa People's Organization and the apartheid-era South African government. Former Namibian Prime Minister Teo Ben-Gurion credits the former envoy with helping his nation achieve independence after decades of civil war. In recent years, Ahtisaari was the chief UN envoy in talks for Kosovo independence. While Russia and Serbia do not approve of statehood for Kosovo, it is now recognized as an independent nation by the United States and most of the European Union. In the midst of the global financial meltdown, America's first regional carbon cap-and-trade scheme has been launched by 10 northeastern states. In the face of congressional inaction, two other regional carbon trading plans, which would cover over half the U.S., are also in the works. The Northeastern Plan, known as RGGI, or REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, calls for a modest 10% cut in carbon emissions from power plants by 2019. REGI, notes the GRIST, the online environmental magazine, fails to take into account recent mild summers in the Northeast, which have resulted in lower-than-expected regional energy use. California is pushing a more ambitious effort, known as the Western Climate Initiative, that goes into effect in 2012. It looks for a 15% emissions cut by 2020 and will cover carbon emissions from transportation, power stations, as well as residential and commercial energy use. Under REGI, more than 220 power plants will have to buy allowances for all CO2 emissions starting in 2009. Plants that don't meet clean air standards will need to buy offsets, like forest plantings, or technology to capture methane from landfills. In many industrial battleground states, union activists are going door to door to boost the turnout for Democrat Barack Obama. Yet the unions are running into resistance in white working-class neighborhoods. As Kyle McDermott, the field director for the United Steelworkers of America, told Labor Notes magazine, "We have people disguise it by saying he does not have enough experience or are not comfortable voting for him. Others are more blatant, saying they refuse to vote for a black man for president." A majority of union members support Obama, but not by the margin the Democrat needs to win major Midwestern swing states. Pat Gillespie of the Philadelphia Building Trades Council noted, "You'd think it would be a 70-30 split, but it's about even, and the only reason I can attribute it to is the color of his skin." AFL-CIO Secretary-Treasurer Richard Trumka took on the race issue directly when he told the Steelworkers Union last July, "There is no evil that inflicted more pain and suffering than racism. It is something the labor movement has a special responsibility to challenge." Unions, in their depleted ranks, are defending Obama from right-wing attacks on his character and false accusations that he is really a Muslim and not a Christian. They are also focusing on Obama's support for their core populist economic message and increased access to health care. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
One week after a record decline in the U.S. stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rebounded with a 936-point rally on October 13th. But despite market gains, many economists predict that markets will continue their roller coaster ride until confidence returns. When it appeared that the $700 billion bailout package recently passed by Congress to buy up toxic mortgage-backed securities wasn't enough to reverse the panic in world markets, the Treasury Department announced that it would begin purchasing equity shares in 9 of the top U.S. banks as part of a new plan to reassure nervous lenders. European nations also pledged billions of dollars to shore up their troubled financial institutions. Presidential candidates Barack Obama and John McCain came forward with their own plans to address the financial crisis that is now hammering Americans struggling to keep their homes and protect their savings. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ross Eisenbray, vice president with the Economic Policy Institute, who talks about the effect of the financial crisis on America's working class and government policies that could be implemented to help the most vulnerable citizens weather the storm and avert future financial meltdowns.
Well, the crisis has been going on for some time for working people. The housing market deflation led to a big drop-off in construction, and that led to more than 500,000 construction workers losing their jobs over the last year. The whole economy has seen a rise in unemployment of 2.2 million people. We now have an underemployment rate of 11%. That means that 1 out of 9 Americans either is unemployed or is working part-time but wants to work full-time and can't find a full-time job. So that's a huge number of people who have already been hurt. And minorities, who are more likely to be low income than whites by and large, are being hit hardest of all. African American unemployment right now is 11.4%, 6.1% overall, but 11.4% for African Americans and almost 12.5% for black men. So it's already had a tremendous effect on people.
Is the worst yet to come? I mean, no way I know we can look into that crystal ball and see it in the future, but from what we know right now, is this all going to sort of devolve into worse conditions down the road, regardless of how fast the turnaround happens on Wall Street?
Yeah, I'm afraid that it's likely that things are going to get considerably worse before they get better. Unemployment is a lagging indicator. So when there's damage to the economy, when the economy is slowing, or when GDP is negative, when the overall growth in the economy actually becomes negative, the effects of that are felt in unemployment many months later. So I think the best estimates are that we're going to see unemployment rise from where it is now, 6.1%, to 7, maybe even 8% next year. And that means, another 1.5 million people losing their jobs and facing a very hard time of, unemployment insurance that only pays half or less of the wages that they had before. So, it's going to be worse.
In your estimation, what are some of the most effective ways that our government's policy can turn around the financial meltdown, unfreeze the credit markets, while also helping the working class and poor citizens that, as you described, are going to get the brunt of this?
To unfreeze the credit markets quickly is going to mean less damage later on. So the plan that's being announced right now, the worldwide plan, and the plan that the Treasury Department has finally agreed to, is to invest in the banks and get stock in the banks rather than just buying the worst assets, the toxic mortgage-related securities, actually recapitalizing. Putting money into the bank so that they have it to lend and will lend it will then, get the economy moving again. And when things pick up and the bank stock increases in price, the government will see its shares increase in price and can sell them and get most or all of this money back.
If you were to be advising the next occupant of the White House, would you be recommending some kind of new version of Roosevelt's New Deal? And maybe you could also suggest some ways to re-regulate financial institutions in this country to avert a similar crisis in the future.
One thing that Roosevelt is known for is having created programs to put people to work. He had a whole range, an alphabet soup of different WPA, CCC, you know, lots of different programs to put people back to work when unemployment was 25% in the Great Depression. Obama is not suggesting something as dramatic as the Roosevelt programs, but he's doing something that makes a world of sense, which is calling on Congress to invest heavily in green jobs, in infrastructure. We can put 1.5 million people to work by just making the investments that should have been made over the last 10 years in mass transit, in roads and bridges, in sewage treatment plants. There are ready-to-go projects that could be started immediately and should be, and Obama has been calling for a big infusion of government resources. But when it comes to re-regulating, there's so much that needs to be done, that you had a complete breakdown of accountability so that someone who wrote a mortgage for a homeowner didn't care whether the homeowner ever could pay it back, could write it knowing that the homeowner would not have the ability to pay it back, but had no accountability. They got their fee for having written the mortgage. It was then sold to Wall Street and broken up into securities. So all of the incentives were wrong. The incentives were to write more and more, even predatory loans, because there was no institution that was accountable for receiving the income over the life of the mortgage.
That was Ross Eisenbray, Vice President of the Economic Policy Institute. Contact the Institute at area code 202-775-8810 or visit their website at epi.org. Criminal justice issues haven't played much of a role in this year's presidential campaign, but with more than 2 million Americans incarcerated at a cost of about $30,000 per person annually, and with racial inequities rampant in the system, the issue is one of grave importance, both from a financial and human rights standpoint. The U.S. now spends $65 billion a year on incarceration, more than any other nation in the world. Among the Republican and Democratic presidential and vice presidential candidates, Democrat Joe Biden had the most active role on these issues, being lead sponsor of the omnibus crime bill that promoted more policing, more incarceration, and enhanced use of the federal death penalty. But he has also been a supporter of some important reform bills, which have yet to pass, such as equalizing penalties for possession of crack cocaine and powder cocaine, and addressing racial bias in the criminal justice system. Sarah Palin is on record supporting the death penalty, but doesn't have much of a record on other criminal justice issues. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, about the voting records of presidential candidates Senators Barack Obama and John McCain on criminal justice issues. He addresses the clear differences between the two while pointing out that Obama has moved toward the center on some of his positions since he began his bid for the White House.
Senator McCain doesn't have a long track record of speaking out on criminal justice policy issues. To a certain extent, when it comes to drug policy, he's indicated some support for diverting lower-level offenders into treatment rather than incarceration. In other areas, he's been fairly supportive of so-called get-tough policies, harsh penalties for different kinds of offenders. But in large part, he's been relatively silent on many of these issues, has supported more policing, law enforcement. Senator Obama has spoken out somewhat on the campaign trail, not an awful lot, but somewhat, about the need for reform of certain policies, particularly some drug laws and the crack cocaine sentencing policies in particular. The campaign in recent weeks in particular strongly endorsed the policing programs and points to the Clinton administration's pledge to put 100,000 new police on the streets and is promoting that quite heavily now as well. So both campaigns have not made this a major issue. To a certain extent, Senator Obama has been talking more about reform issues when these issues have come up.
Mark Maurer, it seems that Obama has moved away from his opposition to the death penalty. How would you describe the two candidates' positions now?
Well, Senator McCain has pretty much uniformly supported the use of the death penalty. Senator Obama does support the death penalty as well, although he would limit it to more extreme circumstances, as he puts it. When Senator Obama was in the legislature in Illinois, he was known for being very engaged in working for reforms to the death penalty process. Illinois has had, you know, just a series of, terrible miscarriages of justice when it comes to the death penalty. And so there's been a series of reforms enacted that would minimize the possibility of an innocent person being convicted, and just put some oversight into police and prosecutorial practices. Senator Obama, earlier in his career, has indicated he was opposed to the death penalty, and now what he calls heinous crimes, or recently when the Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty could not be applied in instances of rape of a child, Senator Obama publicly disputed that and said that he would have supported something like that.
In your summary of the candidates' positions on criminal justice issues, you note that Obama supports the Count Every Vote Act. What's that?
Well, according to our felon disenfranchisement laws, about 5 million people are not eligible to vote because of a current or previous felony conviction. Essentially, right now, we have a situation whereby if you're an ex-felon in West Virginia, you can vote for president. If you're an ex-felon in Virginia, you cannot vote for president. So the argument is, essentially, for national elections like that, we should all be playing by the same set of rules. So under legislation that Senator Obama had co-sponsored, anyone who completed their sentence would be eligible to vote in federal elections, even if they were not permitted to vote in their state on state elections. So he's been coming out in support of that. Senator McCain, we have not heard him say anything on this issue, so we have no reason to believe he's supportive of reform necessarily.
Given that these issues have not been very prominent in the campaign, are you optimistic that any significant change might come from the next administration, whoever's in the White House?
I think it's not so much whether there's a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. I think it's much more likely to happen if there can be a bipartisan movement for reform. Political leaders, both Democrats and Republicans, have been very cautious about embracing any kind of criminal justice reform. They've been very fearful about being tagged as soft on crime. And so I think in both parties, they really need that bipartisan support to give them the sort of political courage that would allow them to step forward and advocate for reform.
That was Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project. To see a chart listing Obama and McCain's positions on 9 criminal justice-related issues, visit the group's website at sentencingproject.org or call them at area code 202-628-0871. Ever since the 2000 presidential election debacle in Florida, the winner of which was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, the integrity of American elections has been in doubt. In 2002, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, which allocated millions of dollars for the purchase of electronic voting machines, which came with privatized software systems and vulnerability to manipulation, creating another set of problems and mistrust. The Help America Vote Act also asks states to remove the names of voters who have died, moved out of state, or no longer qualify to vote. BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Palast, who first reported the illegal purging of voters in Florida prior to the 2000 election, has been raising the alarm about a similar pattern of voter purges in key battleground states in advance of this year's presidential ballot. Now, the New York Times has picked up the story and recently confirmed that tens of thousands of voters in at least 6 swing states have been removed from the rolls or have been blocked from registering in ways that appear to violate federal law. Because of the Democratic Party's success at registering hundreds of thousands of new voters this year, the culling of the voting rolls will disproportionately affect voters backing Barack Obama. Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University, is the editor of a new book titled Loser Take All, Election Fraud and the Subversion of Democracy, 2000 to 2008. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Miller about the evidence he says suggests that a concerted effort is being made by the Republican Party to change the outcome of this November's election, including efforts, possibly now underway, to steal the election by rigging the electronic vote.
The Republicans are necessarily resorting to a dizzying range of tactics, some of them legal, many of them illegal, to do two things, basically. On the one hand, they're working very, very hard at vote suppression. And that's a category of activities that's familiar to anyone who's, you know, paid any attention to American history. It's the kind of thing that goes back to the days of Jim Crow. We're talking about new laws that have been passed to require voters to bring certain kinds of documents to the polls. We're talking about major efforts to interfere with registration drives. We're talking about a kind of national orgy of voter purging. That is, the names of voters are being purged from the rolls in state after state after state. And this category of activity also includes disinformation, sending people to the wrong polling place, intimidating them with threats that if they show up to vote, they'll be arrested because they have fallen behind in their child support payments or they have outstanding parking tickets. I mean, I could talk to you for the next half hour just about scams like these. So that's going on all over the place. And at the same time, and this is a category of activity that gets much less attention because it's still controversial, at least to the corporate media, and that is the apparatus is in place for more election fraud. This refers not to, you know, shrinking the size of the electorate before Election Day and keeping people out of the polls. This refers to basically fixing the numbers electronically after the fact, that is, after people have voted. And this involves the use of electronic voting systems, which now basically will account for between 85 and 90% of the votes cast in this country. I started out by saying the Republicans are doing this necessarily because it seems to me that they can't win this race in any other way. I think the polls by now have made quite clear, and I've discussed this with a number of my friends in the polling business, that McCain is toast, and indeed the Republican Party would be finished, I think, if it weren't for election fraud. I think the Republican Party actually would have been finished a couple of years ago if it weren't for election fraud. So my main concern at the moment is that there be as large a turnout as possible, because the larger the turnout, the harder it is to steal an election. And I'm also eager to see this be the most vigilantly monitored election we've ever had. And the good news is that there's every indication that, on the one hand, the turnout will be very big, and on the other hand, that people will indeed be very carefully monitoring the race.
Mark, as you said before, we have to be psychologically prepared for a surprise Republican victory in November. And you've also said resistance is critical. But what form should that resistance take? What should people have in the back of their mind as we go in to look at the results on election night, November 4th?
Well, you know, as to exactly what we can do in such a situation, I'm really not equipped to say because we're in uncharted territory. But I want to leave you with something much more specific that I referred to before that your listeners absolutely must know about, because it can do a great deal to prevent the theft of this election, actually. And in the event of a theft, can strengthen the hand of those who say no. Okay, what we now have coming out of Ohio is a revelation of immeasurable importance. We have the testimony of a whistleblower whose credentials are unimpeachable. This guy's name, this expert witness, is named Stephen Spoonamore, S-P-O-O-N-A-M-O-R-E. I say that he has unimpeachable credentials because, first of all, he's a conservative Republican. Second of all, he's a former McCain supporter. And third of all, he makes his living as a very prominent and highly successful expert on the detection of computer fraud. Spoonamore's testimony is driving a RICO lawsuit in Ohio. But the most important thing for people to know now is that Spoonamore has named Karl Rove's computer guru, who has helped Rove to steal elections since 2000 when he helped with Florida. He helped with Ohio in 2004. He helped to steal Don Siegelman's reelection victory as governor of Alabama in 2002. The evidence suggests that he helped with the theft of Senator Max Cleland's reelection in Georgia in 2002. Connell is now working for the McCain campaign, and we understand that they have a system in place that will allow them to steal the race in Ohio and five other swing states, okay? And the game plan here is to use the process of discovery in this lawsuit so that we can get these people under oath and on the record answering specific questions about their crimes. The fact is that if people want to learn more about what Spoonamore has revealed, and if they want to donate to the legal war chest to enable the lawyers to push this thing to the max, they can go to a website. The URL is www.rovecybergate.com. People should go there immediately. They can watch some video interviews with Spoonamore. So I want, you know, to leave you tonight with this information, because this is something that will really make a difference, but only if people pay attention to it and act on it as soon as possible.
That was Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University and editor of the book Loser Take All. Visit his website at markcrispinmiller.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.